Lecture 22, The Bible in Contemporary Judaism.
Throughout this course, I have tried to make the important point that the Bible is not a term reserved for Christians alone, and I've tried to trace the story of the Jewish as well as the Christian Bible, even though the emphasis in the course has certainly tilted in the direction of the Christian version, simply because so much happened on that side. Still, as we approach the end of the course, if not of the Bible's story, it is important to consider, however briefly and inadequately, the Bible in contemporary Judaism. Let's begin again with the Enlightenment. For Jews, as for Christians, though in quite different ways, the Enlightenment was a mixed blessing. On the positive side, the ideal of tolerance was spelled out in the form of emancipation of Jews from all of the societal constraints that had been placed upon them through centuries of Christian domination. The sad story of institutionalized Christian anti-Semitism that took the form of exclusion, of exile, of pogroms, of the burning of Talmuds, of the burning of synagogues, of the establishment of the ghetto in Venice. All of these things were lifted first in 1791 in France, and then in the Netherlands in 1796, and other European nations after the revolution of 1848. So Jews experienced in this context legal emancipation. They were now free to be citizens like other citizens. But negatively, official toleration did not mean the demise of anti-Semitism. And in some ways, it made anti-Semitism subtler and perhaps even more pernicious. If the ideal of the Enlightenment is that everybody give up their superstition, their dogma, their silly ways of being religiously different, it becomes even more offensive if this people maintains its specific traditions, which are very much about being different. So Jews' insistence on remaining Jews becomes, if anything, even more offensive than Christians insisting on remaining Christians in this Enlightenment atmosphere. And anti-Semitism continued to be a powerful force in Europe. The Dreyfus Affair from 1894 to 1906, the affair that grew up over the charge that a French soldier who happened to be Jewish was a German spy. And this trial dragged on and on and on, revealed shockingly to many Jews that anti-Semitism had not died and gone away, but was very much powerfully alive in Europe. Another challenge that came about because of emancipation was the increased threat of assimilation, the loss of the Jewish community through being absorbed into the larger, more dominant non-Jewish community. This did not happen so frequently through actual conversion, but it happened through intermarriage, when Jews would marry Christians and be absorbed into the Christian identity. From the 1890s to the 1930s in Germany, for example, fully 5% of the Jewish population each year was lost through intermarriage. Jews responded to these new challenges and the even greater threats that came in the 20th century in diverse ways. A major issue for Jews in Europe and America was translating traditional marks of identity in a changed world, a challenge that was all the greater because of the loss of the ghetto, paradoxically. As long as Jews were forced to live together, were not allowed to exercise full citizenship, were in fact oppressed, the positive side of that experience, as we have seen, was the cultivation of extraordinarily strong bonds of identity, grounded in the synagogue, grounded in the study of Talmud and the observance of God's laws. But now the challenge of assimilation brought Jews back into a diaspora situation much closer to that of the first century Mediterranean world, in which Jews had to figure out how to combine separation and assimilation. How can we remain Jews and yet remain part of the world? There developed then in Europe and in America three different answers to this diaspora question, three major streams of Judaism which represent different responses to modernity. The first is the Reform movement. It began in 19th century Germany and accomplished great popularity in America. This Reform Judaism was a decisive and radical rejection of earlier Jewish history. It called, in fact, for a rejection of Hebrew and the entire Talmudic tradition, in some cases abandoning even circumcision, and definitely rejecting the observance of dietary regulations, kashrut, symbolized in the abandonment of the synagogue as the Jewish place of worship in favor of the temple, which the local congregation was called. The Reform movement called for a return to the Bible alone as the measure of Jewish identity, and in that respect was viewed by many other Jews as a form of Protestant Judaism, and resembled, in fact, the Karaite movement of the 8th century within Judaism that had made a very similar kind of move. Now, one can go back to Scripture alone and find plenty of laws, but what the Reform movement did was go back to the Hebrew Bible and focus upon the prophets, in particular, the prophetic call to social justice. And so the Reform movement focused upon the prophetic nature of the Jewish religion as opposed to the legal dimension of the Jewish tradition. There were several features of the Reform. It put an emphasis on the individual. It called for the use of historical methods in analyzing the ancient texts. It said that Jewish principles should be applied with modern means. It was an explicit embrace of modern culture. It called for complete gender equality in worship and study and observance. And its understanding of tikkun ha'olam, the mending of the world, was through active engagement with movements of social betterment. We can see the Reform movement as, in effect, almost entirely assimilated into the Enlightenment views of modernity. In the 2000 census in the United States, 35% of Jews who claimed a religious dimension to their Judaism belonged to the Reform movement. In 1937, the Reform movement, which had begun so radically, pulled back a little bit. And this was in light of events in Germany, when it became clear that Germany was set on the path of destroying Judaism. And a movement within the Reform called the Reconstruction Movement began to call for the affirmation of a number of traditional Jewish practices. What was fascinating about this, though, is that the reconstruction of these Jewish practices was not because of a religious obligation imposed by God, but rather as a means of asserting and affirming and perpetuating the cultural identity as Jews. In sharp contrast to the Reform movement is the deeply conservative Orthodox community, which has maintained the Talmudic framework for reading the Bible in Hebrew, only in Hebrew, and all the traditional practices associated with it. Indeed, the Orthodox community has a deeply conservative view of the divine inspiration of Scripture. It comes Moshe mi Sinai, it comes from Moses on Mount Sinai. The oral Torah was handed on through the prophets to the sages and then to the rabbis. And all of the traditional practices of the Talmudic tradition are maintained. And what is distinctive about the Orthodox movement is that in many cases, these Talmudic practices are connected to specific European cultural observances that had developed during the time of non-emancipation, clothing, certain cultural practices, the use of Yiddish as a distinctive Jewish language in speech and writing within the community. The extreme examples of the Orthodox movement are the Hasidic communities in certain urban areas where the tzaddik is an absolute ruler, a charismatic figure, and has a transcendent authority. The novels of Chaim Potok, such as My Name is Asher Lev, give a wonderful portrait of the tensions that could be felt by young American Orthodox Jew, Hasidic Jew, coming into contact with higher American university education. Orthodox Judaism is powerful in America. It is the minority position. In the 2000 census, about 10% of religious Jews identified themselves with Orthodoxy. Conservative Judaism tries to strike a middle position, as one might expect, to combine assimilation and separation in a more creative fashion. It affirms the Talmudic framework and the continuation of the religious practices, unlike the Reformed, but they call for a certain degree of assimilation in cultural matters, unlike the Orthodox. So the conservative Judaism also began in Europe in the 1850s as a response to the Reform movement, and in this country took on greater popularity and credibility when the great rabbinic scholar Solomon Schechter became president of the Jewish Theological Seminary in 1906. In the 2000 census, about 26% of religious Jews associate themselves with the conservative movement. Now, all three of these responses to modernity can properly be called diaspora solutions. They simply take for granted that Jews are going to be living in a dominantly non-Jewish environment and therefore have to try to figure out how much to assimilate, how much to separate with respect to continuing to be Jews. Another approach emerged in the 19th century, which might be called not a diaspora solution, but a solution to the diaspora, and calling for a Palestinian solution to a Jewish identity. And this is the movement called Zionism. Zionism can be understood as a contemporary adaptation of the ancient messianic ideal in Judaism. You will recall that messianism in Judaism was not always the major stream within a Jewish religious practice, far from it. In fact, for Christians to characterize Judaism as a religion that's still waiting for its Messiah is a mark of condescension. It is to define Judaism in Christian terms. But nevertheless, messianism has been a feature of Judaism, but it's often involved as much an expectation that's communal and involves the land as it has to do with individual figures. After the false Messiah Jesus in the first century and the failed Messiah Bar Kokhba in the middle of the second century, and above all, after the scandal of the apostate Messiah Sabbatai Zevi in the great commotion caused in Europe in the 17th century, Jewish messianic expectation was pretty emphatically not for an individual figure who would restore the people, but had to do rather more with the future of the people, and specifically the restoration of the people in the land, as at the Passover Seder next year in Jerusalem. And that expresses the Zionist notion. Moses Hess was the first person to speak of a Jewish homeland. And a first Jewish colony was started in Palestine in 1869. And this was the method followed, the establishment of the purchase of land and the establishment of individual colonies that would progressively establish Jews on Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. But a new wave of anti-Semitism in Europe in the 1870s gave great impetus to the movement. And it was Theodor Herzl, who was the new Moses in this quest for a Jewish homeland. In 1896, he wrote Der Judenstaat, which was directly in response to the Dreyfus Affair. Herzl heard on the streets of Paris, when the Dreyfus trial was going on, great mobs of Parisians crying out for death to the Jews. And he became convinced that Jews could never be safe in the diaspora. And the only way in which the Jewish population could be safe was to establish a homeland. It was, of course, the Holocaust or the Shoah and the rise of the State of Israel in the 20th century that represent distinct and yet interrelated challenges to contemporary Jews. The Holocaust from 1933 to 1945, that began with the Nuremberg Laws of 1935 and extended through the murder of 6 million Jews, brought about a fundamental crisis for Jews, not only the danger of extermination, but also a crisis of meaning, of religious meaning. What can we make of the biblical promises in the light of the near extinction of the people? Now, it must be asserted that the Holocaust was not an example of Christian anti-Semitism. It was motivated by Nazi racist ideology and given expression by the technology, efficient technology of the death camps. But it had built upon centuries and centuries of Christian anti-Semitism, and there is as much continuity as discontinuity in this. And it represented a severe challenge because in the messianic expectation of Jews over the centuries within the Talmudic tradition, there was a sense that the Messiah would come when people really were committed to Torah and when the people had suffered enough. And when you have Jewish children who are innocent of any wrongdoing, who are killed precisely because they are Jewish and for no other reason, and they are killed in such numbers as to threaten the extermination of the people, then the question arises, is God really at work in this? And are we God's people? And are the biblical promises empty? The immediate response for many Jews was simply that of post-trauma silence, that we cannot talk about these matters. It is impertinent to talk about God. It is blasphemous to talk about theology in light of the Holocaust. A second response was that illustrated by figures like Elie Wiesel in books like Night, which bear witness, or the Diary of Anne Frank, which in some sense give a human face to that horrific experience of evil and witness to Jewish identity in the midst of that great evil. But another option was presented, for example, by Richard Rubinstein in his book After Auschwitz, who argued that it is no longer possible to use the biblical symbols for God in light of the Holocaust. So this is a fundamental challenge to Jewish identity. Over the course of decades, as we've now moved 60 years past those horrific events, two longer-term responses within Judaism seem to dominate. The first is the primary need is the survival of the children, that Judaism cannot compromise on the issue of the survival of the people, that what counts is not theological ideas but practices, and that the whole point of teaching the children the practices of Judaism is to continue this people. The second is that Midrash is proving to be astonishingly elastic. The capacity of the Jewish ways of reading Scripture to interpret even the most horrible events seem poised and ready to interpret even the Holocaust within the framework of the symbols of Torah. After all, the Exodus was interpreted. The destruction of the temple, the destruction of the city were interpreted through these symbols. It is likely that the Holocaust will be as well. The State of Israel presented another kind of challenge. Israel was established in 1948 and successfully established, undoubtedly because of the experience of the Holocaust and international revulsion at that experience. And it seemed to realize the Zionist ideal, but it is a paradoxical realization of the Zionist ideal because Israel is now a state among other states. What role should Judaism and its laws play within Jewish society. On one side, we have Israelis who are thoroughly secular. They want Israel to be a state like other states with freedom of religion. So Israel need not be Jewish in any distinctive sense. You have hyper-Orthodox Jews in Israel who don't even think there should be a state of Israel. It's anti-religious, that there should not be any Zionism until the coming of the Messiah. And then you have right-wing Jewish religious figures in Israel who argue for the imposition of Jewish laws as the laws of the state. So this is a very confusing thing. And again, what's also deeply ironic, as the headlines constantly show, is that in the politics of the Middle East, the state of Israel itself continues to be a constant source and focus of anti-Semitism. So the issues of where can one safely be a Jew and to what extent can one separate and also assimilate have not gone away because of the establishment of the state of Israel. Now, in terms of reading the Jewish Bible in the light of all this, a radical suggestion for reading the Jewish Bible has been made by Emil Fackenheim, a Holocaust survivor and a student of Hegel, in his book, The Jewish Bible After the Holocaust. Fackenheim argues that the Holocaust is an absolute novum. It is not one historical event among others, but it is a new thing. It has an absolute quality, and therefore represents a fundamental break in the history of Judaism. It is no longer possible to read the Bible the same old way. It is no longer possible to read the story of the people in the same old way. And that all interpretation of the Bible, for Fackenheim, must have as its goal the survival of the people without necessary reference to Judaism as a religion or to God. For Fackenheim, the state of Israel is the resurrection of the dead and the beginning of the Messianic Age. So he takes the birth of Israel as what Torah had been talking about when it talked about the resurrection of the dead. Here it is, and it's not in a heaven, it's not in a future world, it's here and now. What do we do with it? So for Fackenheim, the Jewish Bible, in the light of the Holocaust and of the state of Israel, should be read not in religious terms, but as the history of the Jewish people leading up to the state of Israel. It is, ironically, a Volksgeschichte, the history of a people rather than the history of God's working with the people. So should we be on the land? Well, among other things, Abraham purchased part of the land when he bought a burial place at the tombs. So this kind of argument now begins to be made. For Fackenheim, the heart of the Jewish Bible should be the Book of Esther. Nobody has ever before made that suggestion. But Fackenheim says this should be the canon within the canon for Jews. The reasons? The Book of Esther has two great merits. One, it does not mention God. Thus, we can't talk about God anymore. Secondly, it shows Jews rescuing other Jews through human means. And so the Book of Esther for Fackenheim represents the way in which Jews should understand themselves, and it should be the heart of Torah for Jews. Now, let me turn to some varieties of contemporary Jewish biblical scholarship, because Jewish scholars today take a number of positions with respect to the dominant historical critical paradigm that has become so pervasive among Christians. I should make my transition to this point by saying that Fackenheim's proposal is so radical as not to have met a great deal of response among other Jews, especially religious Jews. But it is provocative and interesting precisely because it states the issues so sharply. Now, Jewish scholars today take several different positions with regard to the dominant historical critical paradigm that I described in the last lecture. Some continue a long-standing commitment to outstanding historical research into ancient Jewish life. Jewish scholars for two centuries have been in the forefront in the study of Judaism and Hellenism in antiquity. This is the Wissenschaftliche tradition of German Jewish scholarship. Figures like Jakob Vernei, Victor Cherakover, and others, which continues today in magnificent historical research. Jews have been among the most important participants in the discovery and analysis of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Figures like Geza Vermesh and Yagdil Yadin, associated in particular with the excavation of Masada. So Jewish historical scholars are very much involved in all of that, and they continue to write biblical commentaries within the dominant historical critical mode. For example, in the interfaith publication venture called the Anchor Bible, Jacob Milgram's two-volume, 3,000-page commentary on the book of Leviticus thoroughly engages both traditional Jewish interpretation and modern historical critical interpretation in engaging that book, which is at the heart of the Jewish tradition. Another response among contemporary Jewish scholars is to engage the Bible with a greater focus on its literary dimensions, whether prose or poetry. This has been a resurgence of an appreciation, especially for the Hebrew language and literature in its aesthetic dimension, as well as its religious dimension. New translations of Torah by the Jewish Publication Society. The Jewish Publication Society had produced the Holy Scriptures in 1917, the entire Tanakh in English, but the Jewish Publication Society came out with a new translation of the Tanakh in 1985. And also others have turned their hand to translation. Robert Alter has produced the Five Books of Moses in an important new English translation. Robert Fox has done a new interpretation of the book of Proverbs that pay close attention to the character of ancient Hebrew. And Jewish scholars have led in the recovery of the literary analysis of the ancient narrative. Meyer Sternberg's The Poetics of Biblical Narrative and Robert Alter's The Art of Biblical Narrative have influenced Christian scholars tremendously in beginning to appreciate not does the Bible tell the truth about the world or does the Bible report history accurately, but how does the Bible mean? How do these narratives create meaning? And Michael Fishbane has shown how the biblical texts are in a constant state of interpretation and reinterpretation, as he has coined a phrase called inner biblical exegesis, that there was a constant, that in other words, what we see in the Talmudic tradition and the Midrashic tradition is taking place already within the Bible itself, a constant process of interpreting and reinterpreting God's work among humans. Still other scholars, especially in the United States, have sought to recover the distinctive character of old Jewish interpretation in modern light, in a contemporary mode. John Levinson, for example, in his book The Death and Resurrection of the Beloved Son, it's not about the death and resurrection of Jesus, The Death and Resurrection of the Beloved Son, the transformation of child sacrifice in Judaism and Christianity, is a study of the traditions associated with the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, and how that powerful story found expression both in Jewish and Christian traditions. Or James Kugel, in his monumental book, The Bible as It Was, or his smaller study in Potiphar's House, has shown how the ancient tradition of reading and rereading the Bible can give new light throw new light on the meaning of the Tanakh. One thing is clear in all of this is that at least within the halls of universities, at least within the environment of the academy, in conversation with Christian scholars, On every side, apologetics has been replaced by mutual respect and a desire to learn from each other.